Hurricane Iota leaves a path of destruction in Central America. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Iota hit Nicaragua as a Category 4. We'll get an update on the last couple of weeks of storms that have devastated Central America. Also, it's been almost 15 years when an unknown gunman shot and killed Brian Patta, a star player for the University of Miami. The family has remained steadfast, but frustrated that police have not made an arrest.
We don't hear nothing from my son.
We'll talk with the ESPN investigators who've looked into the possible suspects. And finally,
the story is totally invented.
Wow.
It is my most autobiographical book.
A conversation between WLRN editorial director Alicia Zuckerman and author Judy Bloom. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Hurricane Iota is still ripping through parts of Central America. It's expected to weaken to a tropical storm this afternoon, but that's only after it made landfall in Nicaragua last night as a Category 4, leaving behind washed-out bridges, flooding, and destroyed homes. At least one person was killed on the Colombian island of Providencia, east of Nicaragua. Experts have warned about the lasting catastrophic impacts. Some areas are only beginning to recover from Hurricane Ida that battered the region just 2 weeks ago. Francisco Larios is a professor at Miami-Dade College and the leader of the nonprofit Paz Nicaragua Foundation, and he joins us now. Francisco, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is WLRN's Latin America correspondent, Tim Padgett. Tim, always a pleasure.
Hi, Luis. How are you?
Francisco, I want to start with you. What are you hearing from people in Nicaragua right now?
Well, a number of things. First of all, there is there's not many people who have been reported dead, but the destruction is very significant in the northeastern part of the country, and surprisingly, in the southern part, closer to Costa Rica due to flooding. There's also no power in many areas of the northern regions of Nicaragua. And then there's the problem of helping the victims of the hurricane, which is complicated by the political situation there and by the manipulation that the government makes of foreign aid and the efforts that the government makes to prevent non-governmental organizations from helping. So that actually leaves a lot of these victims who are among the poorest citizens of the country and in a very dire situation and without any proper help from the government or basically from anyone.
Yeah. Tim, I mean, other parts of Central America have taken a beating, not just from Iota, but you had Ida before that. But, I mean, from the last couple of weeks, what's happened? What do we see?
Well, as you just mentioned, you had a tropical storm Ida batter mostly Honduras and Guatemala 2 weeks ago. And it was mostly northern Honduras that got the brunt of it. And you have the officials estimate more than 150,000 people were displaced from their homes by the flooding there. You had whole towns in northern Honduras like La Lima and parts of the big city San Pedro Sula just completely underwater after that storm. And across all of Honduras, because of that kind of rain, you had the ground just completely saturated. And then comes a hurricane like Iota, which will bring even more rain and obviously more flooding and mudslides and things of that nature because of the effects that Ida already left behind.
And Iota, again, when it hit, it was a Category 4 storm. Have we seen anything that big in the area in a while?
Not in a while. We haven't seen a hurricane of this magnitude since 1998 really hit this part of Central America. That was Hurricane Mitch, which was Category 5. But even worse than its winds was the fact that it just laid about 75 inches of rain over Honduras and Nicaragua and other parts of Central America for a matter of days. It just hung over the isthmus for almost a week. And that ended up killing more than 11,000 people, as I recall. And that was probably one of the worst recorded hurricanes ever to hit Central America.
Francisco, I'm thinking about what you said a moment ago. And one of the tricky parts when you talk about, you know, parts of, you know, Central America, some of that region, because of the governments, it's going to be hard to get in to get help. How is your organization able to do anything right now?
Well, at this point, you know, our hands are pretty much tied. This is what's going on. If they have recently passed laws that criminalize essentially the sending of government directly to non-governmental organizations that the dictatorship is actually targeting. And so the only way in which people are getting help in the affected areas is either by directly by government, which is using this as a propaganda effort with caravans of flag waving, you know, Sandinista flag waving people going there presumably to help, or through the funds that go channeled, you know, to the organizations that depend or work with the United Nations system. The problem, I am told by people on the ground, is the overhead of the non-governmental organizations, of the United Nations organizations, eats up about 40% of whatever donations.
Yeah, so, Tim, help us understand, again, some of this challenge of getting around governments in this region and trying to help people.
Well, in Honduras, for example, I mean, just picking up on what Francisco was saying about this awful dysfunctional relationship between the central government in Nicaragua and remote areas of Nicaragua, like the northern swath of the country that IOTA is tearing through last night and this morning. We have a lot of indigenous and rural communities that are very, very remote, as I said, cut off. In Honduras, the government there is extraordinarily corrupt and dysfunctional. And on top of that, as we said before, you had ADA already come through Honduras, and that has, because of all the displaced people there, that has taken away a lot of whatever shelter capacity the country had already. So in the wake of IOTA, you're going to have very, very little shelter capacity for these people to go to after all the flooding and mudslides, et cetera, that's going to hit after this storm. And the government in I was talking with people from aid groups in Tegucigalpa yesterday, and they said basically in terms of preparation before the storm and help after the storm, they really feel that people are just sort of on their own because the Honduran government just isn't in any sort of condition really to respond to this or to help them get prepared for it beforehand.
Again, we're talking with WLRN's Latin America correspondent, Tim Padgett. Also speaking with Francisco Larios. He's a professor at Miami-Dade College. He's also the leader of the nonprofit Paz Nicaragua Foundation. And we're just discussing what happened over the last 48 hours. Hurricane Iota making landfall last night in Nicaragua as a Category 4. It's now a Category 1. But again, just how it's battered the region. And before that, it was Hurricane Ada. We heard from Jacqueline Del Arca. She is a student at the University of Miami. She's from Honduras, and she shared with us how her family's been affected by the storms.
Just seeing the horrible floods that people were going through all across my social media, through all my group chats. I remember I was working, I was starting work, and I just started seeing all of these things, and I completely broke down. The first thing I did was check in my family. One of my aunts unfortunately lost a pig farm she had. But in the end, you know, we say that life is the most important and precious thing. But at the same time, when you see so many people lose everything they own, it's just completely heartbreaking and devastating to even see that. See your people suffering and see your people just be completely underwater. It's mentally and emotionally challenging.
Jacqueline has been leading efforts locally and on social media to send aid to those affected by Ada and Iota. And of course, we'll have information that you can check out on our social media at WLRN Sundial if you want to find ways to help those affected. Tim, all of this is happening and we're in a pandemic. And I'm wondering, you know, right, if the governments are that dysfunctional, then, I mean, that's just piling up on top of more problems.
just adds another layer to the tragedy. After Ada, I mean, that was one of the big themes of the discussions I had with aid workers there. They were, even before Ada, Honduras was suffering a pretty catastrophic curve with regard to COVID cases and deaths compared to other countries in Central America and Latin America. And they were very worried that Ada was simply going to make that even worse. Because if you look at these images in the aftermath of Ada, you had dry patch ground that they could live on, you know, until help gets there. And they're all huddled together, no social distancing whatsoever. If they were able to find shelters, they would be crowded into the shelters. And, the feeling is that the COVID pandemic in Honduras is simply going to be exacerbated and will surely be exacerbated even more in the wake of Iota.
What has it been like trying to get help to people, even before the storms, helping people in dealing with this pandemic?
One of the awful things about the pandemic in Nicaragua has been the authoritarian regime's utter dismissal and disregard for the crisis there, for the COVID crisis in Nicaragua. They have Daniel Ortega, the left-wing authoritarian leader there, has just utterly dismissed the severity of it there, and he has, promoted large gatherings over the past year, and so, you know, this storm will simply make that situation worse in Nicaragua.
Francisco, I wanted to ask you your take on that, on the issue of the pandemic and what it's been like to try to help people before these storms hit, and how you think it's going to make it harder.
Well, as in general terms, it has been hard to help, and it's been also a manipulated management of the pandemic with misinformation or non-information by the government. In recent times, I think there's been, in some indications, a reduction of the impact of the pandemic, but the expectation is by local doctors that this will pick up over the next few weeks. But again, there is no government effort to really handle the pandemic. There are no resources also. I mean, this is a bankrupt government. There are sanctions that are not directly against the government revenues, but that have impacted on confidence. And so because of the political problems, the economy is in a very deep recession.
Yeah. And Francisco, the other thing too, I wanted to ask you, what are you doing right now? Are you gathering things? Are you gathering any donations in hopes that maybe you might be able to get to some folks?
Well, at this point, our next effort would be to actually not collect goods, but to collect money that would, hopefully, we will be able to have delivered at some point. But there's really no assurance of that at the moment. And I'm being discouraged, actually, by our contacts that we have on the ground from doing much, because they say, even us down here, they don't let us do much. They block us every step of the way.
Yeah. Tim, to finish up, we're going through this transition in this country between administrations, but also because of the relationship we have with some of these countries. I mean, what role would the U.S. usually play in this situation?
Well, I was on the phone with Southcom this morning, and they have a large presence, for example, Southcom being the Southern Command, the military Southern Command that's based here in Doral. And they have a large presence in Honduras, and I think that'll help a lot in terms of getting U.S. aid distributed through Honduras. But you're right. I mean, there has been a difficult relationship between the Trump administration and Central American countries because the Trump administration has been focused almost solely on getting countries like Honduras to cooperate on immigration, and there hasn't been a lot in any other areas. So the aid network and cooperation that we have between the U.S. and Central America is not functioning as it has in the past. And so it'll be interesting to see then how quickly the U.S. as a result is able to jump in and help people in the aftermath of these two storms.
He is Tim Padgett, WLRN's Latin America correspondent. I also want to thank Francisco Larios, professor at Miami-Dade College and leader of the nonprofit Paz Nicaragua Foundation. Francisco, Tim, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Lewis.
Thank you, Lewis.
And we'll keep you up to date on this story as we get more information. Well, still to come, the death of a University of Miami football star, Brian Potta, 14 years ago, is now the focus of an investigation from ESPN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Brian Potta was en route to becoming a professional football player in the NFL. The University of Miami defensive tackle was being recruited by teams across the country for his athleticism and his raw talent. And then on the evening of November 7th, 2006, Brian Potta was shot and killed outside of his apartment in Kendall, Florida. 14 years later, his death is unsolved. ESPN investigative reporters Elizabeth Merrill and Paula Levine have spent the past several years investigating the case, speaking with Brian Potta's friends and family to better understand who he was and why this case remains unsolved, even if it meant suing the Miami-Dade Police Department for more information. Paula and Elizabeth join us now via Zoom. Paula, Elizabeth, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Paula, let me start with you. How did you guys get involved in this story? This is a 14-year-old story from South Florida. Why did ESPN get interested in it?
Well, this story, I actually sort of came a bit late to this story. It started with some producers, feature producer Dan Aruda, associate producer Scott Frankel, senior producer Ben Weber, all on the TV side. And they were looking into this as something that they wanted to dig deep into because they thought it would make a good podcast. And I didn't get, so I have sort of a unique role at ESPN. I do a lot of work with data journalism and public records, and people sort of come to me when they might need some help or advice on an investigative story. And when they really started pushing back to the Miami-Dade Police Department or struggling to find people, they reached out to me initially, and it was like, hey, can you maybe help us locate some people, some of the former people who used to live in the apartment complex? And then, hey, you know, can you maybe pull a record or two for us? And then as I started getting more into it and my editors started getting more involved, then I jumped in and started doing some of the interviews with the police department.
The police, and, the police department actually looked to you for help.
They did. They wanted us. Well, I think Liz can speak to that a little bit more because she was more involved back then.
Yeah, Elizabeth, tell me a little bit about that. I don't know if I've heard anything like that before.
Yeah, so I was just going back and looking at my email for the first email that I received for this story, and it was November 8th, 2017. So it was the day after the 10-year anniversary of his death. And it's from a TV higher-up who asked if I'd like to help participate in the story. And it was possibly going to be for SportsCenter featured at the time. You know, the Miami-Dade police reached out to us in late 2017 to Ben Weber. I think he was the first one to sort of pick this up because they wanted to generate some interest in the case. So, yeah, they actually, and I think initially that they wanted, like, they figured maybe we could do a short feature on SportsCenter or something,
right,
or on game day, because to just draw some awareness, right? And after examining it for a little bit and talking to the family, we knew it was something a lot bigger than
let's dive into this story. So people who are here remember Potta, but if not, I mean, Potta was a popular player on the team, and again he was expected to go in the NFL draft. But just remind us a little bit about his life and his friends here, who he was.
Well, Brian grew up in Little Haiti. He grew up sort of under the grip of poverty. You know, he was the youngest of nine kids. His mom pretty much raised them on her own, and you know, he had a lot of older siblings who helped along that process. But, you know, when they were kids, they didn't have a lot of money. So what him and some of his brothers who were closer in age, they'd go to the park and they'd play sports, whether it was football or baseball or whatever they could do until it got dark out. And that was sort of their way of getting through the days. and they became really good athletes as a result of it, kind of pushing each other. Yeah.
And you know, he had a, well, eventually had this passion for football, but he overcame a lot of the challenges in his life. He had many. This is his brother, Edric Pata, reading a portion of his brother Brian's college essay. Let's take a listen.
Life has always been a challenge, an obstacle of test of who I am and what I will become. My name is Brian Pata, and this is my story. A story of love, perseverance, remorse, and hope.
Paula, how is Brian being thought of and memorialized among his friends and family all these years later?
Well, in the initial years, I think there were more sort of outward expressions of, you know, marking the anniversary, talking about the need for people to come forward. And in the ensuing years, some that's faded. And now it's more, you know, it's what we've seen in the past few years, you know, shout outs on social media by, you know, some former teammates and his family, who they're the ones who I think are really keeping this, really, really pushing this forward and really trying to keep his name out there, visiting the grave. And for his mother and his siblings, it's not just an annual thing. He is in their hearts and he's in their thoughts every day.
And it has to be that much more difficult, the fact that, again, no one's been arrested in this case. Paula, take me back to November 7, 2006. Based on the interviews with friends, family, police records, everything that you got, what's your understanding of what happened that evening?
So it was a Tuesday. It was a pretty average Tuesday. He had practice. He had some stuff to do on campus, and he is, so the where, you know, where this really starts is he is leaving practice, sees some of his teammates, picks him up to take him, drop him off at the dorms, and, you know, says, "Hey, you know, we'll see you tomorrow." It's dark, but I think it's important to remember that we're not talking like it's late midnight or anything. It's just only around 7 p.m. And he's driving home. His roommate is also a teammate. He was headed home too, but he had to stop for gas on the way. So Brian Pata is ahead of him. He's on the phone with his brother Fednall, and as Fednall remembers, they're just having a casual conversation, talking about paint colors for a car they're fixing up. And Fednall remembers that the call kind of suddenly dropped. And based on what we think would have happened is if Brian took the most direct route home, it would have been about, you know, the 4 miles. He would have pulled into the parking lot outside of his apartment complex, like I said, around 7 o'clock. And what police believe happened after that is he pulls into his parking space. He gets out of his car. Someone comes out of the darkness and shoots him in the head, and kind of in the back of the head on the left side, by his left ear, with a medium caliber lead bullet. He falls to the ground. His girlfriend, Jada Brody, was inside their apartment. She comes out because she thought she heard an argument downstairs, and she runs down the parking lot and she sees him unresponsive, realizes kind of what's happened, runs back up to call 911, comes back out. By this point, that teammate has arrived and in his pickup, he sees his friend on the ground.
Yeah.
By this point, you know, they've called 911. Someone else is there to try to do CPR, you know, and then obviously when the, you know, first responders arrive, there's not much they can do. They pronounce him dead at 7:07 p.m.
Right. And you know, Elizabeth, one of the things we know in an investigation by police is those first few hours, those first couple of days, so important in the investigation. What do we know about what Miami police did in that time shortly after the murder?
Well, they had a lot of leads to pursue because Brian was involved in a lot of things. He had a, you know, you think of most college athletes, they're just constantly busy with school and football, but he had a side business restoring old cars and tricking them out and selling them for a profit. And so, you know, he talked to a lot of people who were sort of in this underworld of like selling various car parts, fancy car parts, rims and such. So, and so he had, there was that they had to follow up on. There was a lead about the rims that he was driving, that they were possibly stolen, and somebody being angry about that, seeing them at a flea market. There was, he had ex-girlfriends, one of whom wielded a knife at him once. He had a rocky relationship with his live-in girlfriend. He angered some people on his team. Now, look, you cover college pro football, you know that teammates fight. They fight in training camp. They fight in locker rooms.
Yep.
But this was a little bit more of a heated argument and heated fights. And it involved a girl, which a lot of times often happens. So he had a lot of things going on.
Yeah, and that fight, I want to get to that in just a moment, because that is someone you guys were looking at very carefully. Again, I'm talking with ESPN investigative reporters Paula Levine and Elizabeth Merrill. They've spent a couple of years reporting and investigating on the death of Brian Patta. He was the University of Miami football star who was shot and killed in 2006. And you could read their reporting. Just go to our social media. We have a link to their story at WLRN Sundial. So as you mentioned, the Miami Police Department reached out to you directly, you know, to get the word out on the case. In 2017, the Patta family expressed frustration about the lack of progress made in the case. Here's Jeanette Patta. This is audio courtesy of Miami-Dade Police.
I can't imagine 10 years now. We don't hear nothing from my son. They don't work in the case. So what? The system don't work. I have to say something. It's hurt me.
Paula, what have we heard from the Patta family about their communication with police, and what have we heard from police about where are they in this?
Well, the Patta family has told us all along that they've been frustrated because they feel that the police department has not really made any progress on this case since, you know, within the couple of years after he died. And they, you know, they feel like they should have received more updates, that they should have, you know, there were things that they learned about the case from us. And during our investigating, that I think they feel they should have learned directly from the police as it came about. As far as what the police have said to us, this gets kind of interesting. But what they said to us during countless interviews over the years was that they never had a suspect. They never had a prime suspect. You know, you'd ask the detective, you know, who are you looking at? You know, who did you really focus on? And you sort of got this answer, well, it could be anybody. Everybody's a suspect. You know, very, very much that this was just a completely, completely open speculation as to who it could be. And,
that changed.
Yes, that did change. And that's one of the reasons that we really pressed hard to get records in this case.
Was that after, because you put in a request, a Freedom of Information Act request from the police for the case files. Is that when that changed? What did those documents tell you?
So our efforts to get records went kind of back and forth for a number of years. And it wasn't until we got attorneys involved that we received what was an almost 200-page primary investigation report. And it was a lot of material, and we learned a lot, but there were huge sections of it that were redacted, meaning that either full pages were blacked out, or sentences or parts of sentences were blacked out. And then there were thousands of pages of supplemental materials, and same thing, like there would be entire pages withheld or sections of pages that were blacked out. And while, you know, well, they would say, well, you know, you got most of it, the stuff that was blacked out was some of the information that we really felt we needed to be able to tell a full and accurate story of how far they actually went in this investigation.
Yeah, I want to ask you, because there's one person in particular I want to ask you about. But before that, Elizabeth, let me ask you this. You guys spoke with the Cold Case Foundation. This is a network of law enforcement specialists that work to crack long unsolved cases. What did they tell you about why this case, what they thought of this case and why it's taken so long, and about the Miami-Dade police and how they've handled it?
So we reached out to Greg Cooper and Dean Jackson of the Cold Case Foundation and kind of gave them our homework, you know, all those files, those documents to pour through, and then met with them in Salt Lake City in February. And what they said was that they thought the case was solvable. They thought that it was an experienced killer who was probably the offender. And that, you know, there was some kind of relationship, that the key of the case was finding the relationship between the victim and the offender.
Yeah. So briefly tell me, who is Rashawn Trayvon Jones and his role in this story?
Well, Rashawn Jones, in some ways had like a background like Brian. I mean, he was a guy who was trying to provide a better life through football, you know, came from some tough circumstances. Was a ballyhooed recruit. He's from Lake City, Florida. And, you know, along the way, he made some wrong decisions and, you know, failed some drug tests. The day that Brian was killed, he had failed his third drug test and was kicked off the team. So this is all happening on that same day.
And what have the police said about him? And have they ever made him a suspect? Have they ever talked about arresting him?
They haven't, you know, they have been mum on who they consider a suspect from the get-go.
They have not directly said he's a suspect, but this kind of goes back to what I was alluding to earlier, which is how their answers somewhat changed. So after we ended up suing them for these records, and during the hearing, one of the officers is testifying and talks about how some of the information that was redacted pertains to their key witness as well as our primary person of interest. And it so happened that that information was a number of pages pertaining to Rashawn Jones. It began with statements about him and parts about him. He was the only player who didn't show up the night that players are being questioned. And there was one last thing, which is there was one page that they gave us in the records, a cover sheet, right? Each person they focused on had a cover sheet with his or her name on it. And Rashawn Jones's cover sheet was the only one that said suspect on it.
Yeah. Let me finish with this only because of time. I want to hear from both of you. From all the research you've done, do you think there is a suspect? Do you know who that is? Do you believe it's Rashawn?
I don't think, I mean, I'm not in a position to say whether we believe Rashawn is a suspect or not. I can tell you what the Miami-Dade police have focused on. You know, there were several people that they looked at. There are, you know, some other people that we lay out in the story that they looked pretty closely at. You know, their hope, well, their statement was, there's just one sort of last piece of the puzzle that needs to come together before they can actually put this to bed and maybe arrest someone. So I wish I knew.
And by the way, since the podcast, the ESPN Daily podcast came out with the story, have you heard anything from anybody in the story who's come forward?
Yes. So we set up a tip line and we have some calls. We have received several calls that we are following up on.
Okay. This is an incredible story. Anybody who lived here remembers the tragedy, but incredible how all these years later, still waiting to see. Again, talking with ESPN investigative reporters Paula Levine and Elizabeth Merrill, you can check out their story, their years-long investigation into the shooting of Brian Patta. Just find it on our social media at WLRN Sundial, because there's a lot to the story that we couldn't get to, but please check it out. Paula, Elizabeth, thank you so much for the insight.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, still to come. Let's change things up a little bit. We're going to take a stroll around Miami Beach with author Judy Blume as part of this year's Miami Book Fair. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The Miami Book Fair is entirely online this year, featuring author interviews and events that thousands of Book Fair fans will be viewing throughout the week. The idea is to give viewers an experience with the authors that's memorable in its own right. Well, several years ago, WLRN editorial director Alicia Zuckerman had a dream experience with one of her favorite writers, Judy Blume. The iconic author behind dozens of children's, young adult, and adult fiction books spent 2 years of her childhood in Miami Beach, two extremely important years, and now she lives in Key West. Blume's young adult novel, starring Sally J. Friedman as herself, follows a young girl who moves from New Jersey to Miami Beach in the 1940s. It was one of Alicia Zuckerman's favorite books growing up. Alicia had the idea, what if I walk with Judy Blume through Sally J. Friedman's neighborhood on Miami Beach? Well, the end result was the Sally J. Friedman reality tour with Judy Blume. This is a longer version of the original radio piece. It's part of the Book Fair's Florida Writer's Map, and you could go to the Book Fair's website for a video version that includes captions so you could read along.
I'm Alicia Zuckerman, and this story starts with a walk in my neighborhood.
I'm walking across 13th Street from my apartment directly to where she lived on Miami Beach when she was a kid at 1330 Pennsylvania Avenue. 1300, almost there, Sunbright Furnished Apartments, 1330 Pennsylvania Avenue. I am here.
Hi.
Hi. Oh my God, it's such an amazing
this is so exciting.
Treat to meet you. Exciting for you, it's
yes,
exciting for me.
Exciting for me because it's my childhood.
Oh my God, I love your glasses. Purple is my favorite color.
Mine too.
Wow.
This is Judy Blume, my childhood hero. Judy Blume, who wrote Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, Super Fudge, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, Deanie, Blubber, Forever. But we're here to talk about starring Sally J. Friedman as herself. The book came out in 1977, and I loved this book. I read it over and over. When I moved to Miami Beach as an adult, there were things about the neighborhood that felt familiar, which didn't make any sense. I grew up in New York. I'd only been to Miami Beach twice, once to visit my great-grandma Sadie when I was about five, and once for a bachelorette party. But it was like I kind of had memories of this place. From reading the book, from reading starring Sally J. Friedman as herself. 1330 Pennsylvania Avenue is where Sally lived, and it's where Judy Blume lived. It's also the first stop on what I've decided to call the Sally J. Friedman reality tour.
Yeah, this was all called Central Beach when I lived here. I think South Beach must have come later. This surely was the original building here. It was so different. Oh, it was so different. There was a big fish pond in the center of this courtyard.
And that's
in the
book.
There was always a courtyard. Oh, yeah, it's all in the book.
They took a taxi to 1330 Pennsylvania Avenue, a pink stucco U-shaped building with a goldfish pool in front.
Those 2 years were the most important 2 years of my childhood. We came here for the winters, for the school year, really. My mother, of course, wouldn't leave New Jersey until she thought hurricane season was over. So we went to school in Elizabeth, New Jersey until just before Halloween. And then we came to Miami Beach. For 2 years we did this, 46, 47, 47, 48.
Judy Blume's family came here because, like in the book, her brother got a kidney infection, and the doctor didn't think it would be a good idea for him to spend the winter up north. That was pretty common back then. There were lots of snowbirds for health reasons, and lots of those families were Jewish, like Judy's.
It was all, you know, grandma, mother, and children, and then the fathers stayed behind wherever they were.
Mom opened the windows while Sally went looking for the bedrooms. But all she could find was a tiny kitchen, a breakfast nook, a bathroom, and an alcove. I thought you said this place was interesting, Sally said to her mother.
You know, it was right after World War II, and things were scarce. So this was a little furnished apartment. Between the one room, the living room, and the bathroom was this little L with a Murphy bed, which I thought was just the greatest thing I had ever seen.
You see, it fits right into the wall.
My mother and my grandmother slept together in that Murphy bed. When my father came down, my grandmother moved into the living room with where my brother and I slept. We each had little, what was called a day bed. But you know, I didn't think there was any hardship. I loved it. I loved the freedom of living here. I loved playing outside every night till it got dark. I loved that my mother seemed so much less anxious.
In the book, Sally's mom is actually incredibly anxious, nervous about everything. Athlete's foot, airplanes, cats.
He was the most beautiful cat Sally had ever seen. But mom said he might be pretty, but cats can be full of worms, so watch out.
But the book is basically a slightly fictionalized autobiography of Judy Blume's life here during those 2 years.
Miss Swetnick, Sally called.
My fourth grade teacher, Helen Swetnick.
That was her real name?
That was her real name.
And you put her real name in the
book. No, I was insane, and nobody stopped me from using real names. But Peter Hornstein is really Peter Hornick.
Oh, that's
Sally felt a tug on her right braid. She whipped around in her seat to tell Peter Hornstein to leave her hair alone once and for all.
You know, he dipped my braids in his inkwell, though. He did do that. But, oh, I loved him. He may have been the first boy I loved.
She turned 9 here and then 10.
I think it was in these 2 years that I spent in Miami Beach that I lost my shyness. I was a fearful child, anxious and fearful. I don't remember being that way here.
Even as she was getting less shy and less anxious, she still lived a lot of her life inside her head.
I played a lot with paper dolls because in my head, I was making up stories, and someone came to my mother and said, she is too old to be playing with paper dolls.
Sally heard her say to Mom, when my Bubbles was that age, she was sewing her own clothes and reading fine literature from the library.
But I wasn't playing with paper dolls like a little kid. I was playing with paper dolls with all these really exciting melodramas going on inside my head. That's what made me a writer, not writing stories down, but loving having the stories inside my head. You know, when I started to write, I had a place to put all that anxiety and fear, and I was fearless in my writing. And I don't know how that works, just two different parts of the brain.
After we leave her old apartment building, we walk a couple of blocks over to her old school.
And the reason that my parents took this apartment, I started to tell you and then didn't, I believe now, is because it was so close to the schools and they wanted the children to be able to walk to school easily.
1420 Washington Avenue.
Okay.
So it's
two blocks down, one block over, right?
It's very close, yeah.
Central Beach Elementary School.
Now it's Feinberg Fisher K through 8.
And on my first day, my mother walked me, and we stopped, and I picked a hibiscus, and I put it in my hair.
Just like Sally.
Just like Esther Williams. And on day one of going to Central Beach Elementary School, when I went to use the girls' room, they had no doors on the stalls. No doors. And I wouldn't go. Well, we'll ask the guard. Hi, I was a student here in the late 40s, and I'm a writer now. And I wondered if I could just show her the courtyard.
What's your name?
Judy Blume.
Judy Blume.
Let me take you. I mean, five less.
Thank you.
Yes, of course. This is Judy Blume.
Oh my God.
Yes.
I didn't have a library in my elementary school in New Jersey, but here there was a school library, which was very exciting. So this may be the back of what was my school. But it was this, you know, a school built around a courtyard. It was very exotic. I mean, it was so exotic. Everything about Miami Beach was so incredibly exotic. You know, the grass was different. I can remember the first time I walked on that kind of stiff grass. It was so different. I loved it.
From the school, we go over to Flamingo Park.
This was like a long bike ride, I thought, from where I lived. It's really only a few blocks. You know, it was a big thing to be able to go to the park by yourself on a bike, I mean, with your friends.
Sally and Shelby rode to the park and watched Georgia Blue Eyes and his friends play ball. Shelby said, "I really want to kiss him, don't you?" "I wouldn't mind," Sally answered.
I have no idea who he was, Georgia Blue Eyes, but we all loved Georgia Blue Eyes. I think he was like a year older than us, I'm not sure. So the Pittsburgh Pirates, this was, what do they call it, the winter home? And my brother used to hang over a fence like this. I don't know if it was this fence. And the big star, and certainly for Jews, was Hank Green? Hank
Greenberg? No.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, Hank Greenberg. I shortened his name, yes, when I said Green. Hank Greenberg, yes. And he was gorgeous. He was a great, great Jewish hunk athlete. Every Friday night, we went to roller skating in the park. I can still remember Dance Ballerina Dance. That was a Nat King Cole song. And that was one of the songs that was played when we were roller skating. Dance Ballerina Dance.
Dance Ballerina Dance. And do your pirouette in rhythm with your aching heart. Dance Ballerina Dance.
From Flamingo Park, we walk over to the beach to look at the ocean.
Look at this. Oh, God, it's so great. I loved the ocean.
She loved the ocean.
Low tide. You walked forever.
The water here was warm and clear and blue-green, and when it was low tide, you could walk way, way out.
My grandmother would prepare a big basket with lunch, and my favorite was egg salad sandwiches. And I loved the crunch, which I now realize was sand. You know, maybe on my hands or something. It was always crunch. It wasn't eggshells. You know, I have a really good memory from my childhood.
For most of us, if we're honest, memories of our childhood are foggy. Maybe we remember details of big things like a great birthday present or getting hurt badly, but not day-to-day life, not like Judy.
I think that people who write for and about kids, I think we just have a special connection to our own childhoods.
But there's actually one theme of Sally J. Friedman that didn't happen. Like Sally, Judy was always making up stories in her head, but not like this.
So Hitler goes to his desk and gets his knife, and he slowly slashes off each of her fingers. She watches as her blood drips onto his rug, covering the huge swastika in the middle.
A little bit after she gets to Miami Beach, Sally becomes utterly convinced that Hitler is alive and living at 1330 Pennsylvania Avenue, disguised as an old Jewish man who speaks with a Yiddish accent and reads the foreword.
"Dear Mr. Zavodsky, I think you are a person who is wicked and evil. I think you are worse than a regular murderer or kidnapper. I think you are a person with the initials A.H.
I assume there was a real Mr. Zavodsky.
No. No, that
there
part
wasn't.
No, that part of the story is totally invented. No.
Wow.
It is my most autobiographical book, but Mr. Zavodsky, that was totally in Sally's head, as all of
so
her
Judy Blume was less of an anxious kid when she lived in Miami Beach, less freaked out about the world, but Sally believed Hitler was living in her apartment complex.
Well, because that's when the book is set. I mean, the war colored everything. How could you write about that time and not think of it, you know? You know, I just wanted to tell you,
there's
a reason that I wrote that book. And that was a teacher who wrote to me to say that she was doing a study of people in creative fields. And what were they like as children? In order to help the kids that she was teaching become more creative. And I got that letter and I thought, oh, this is such a good idea. And that reminded me of the child I was when I was Sally's age. And that's why I wrote the book.
And we've come to the end of the Sally J. Friedman reality tour, a walk through Judy Blume's Miami Beach. I hope you get out there and take this walk, and I hope you read the book or read it again. Thanks to Goldie Lieberperson for being the voice of Sally J. Friedman, and to WLRN, where the original version of this tour first aired. I'm Alicia Zuckerman. Thanks for listening.
Psst. WLRN's editorial director, Alicia Zuckerman, speaking with author Judy Blume. You could find a link to the Sally J. Friedman Reality Tour and the Florida Writer's Map from this year's Miami Book Fair by going to our website, WLRN.org. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, November 17th. We don't have a show tomorrow. It's the Miami-Dade School Board meeting, but don't worry. We'll be back on Thursday live. And, of course, remember, we're a podcast, so you can always find us on your podcast app, and that way go back and listen to all your favorite shows. By the way, as I mentioned, the Miami Book Fair is happening all week. You can hear our former conversations with the Sundial Book Club authors like Craig Pittman and Edwidge Danticat, who are part of this year's event. Again, just find us at WLRN.org. I'm Luis Hernandez. Stay safe. Be good to each other. We'll talk to you again live on Thursday. Okay.